This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, is there really a move toward the center in Washington? Newsweek puts limits on anonymous sources, and a pregnant high school student is banned from her own graduation ceremony. Joining us from our New York bureau is Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. Charles Ogletree, professor of law at Harvard University, he joins us from the university studios. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, comes to us today from NPR's Washington headquarters. All right, folks, George, let me start with you. The idea of what we're seeing out of Washington, a lot being made, whether the centrists are now making a move for political power, are they in fact just a blip on the radar screen, this partisan kumbaya singing? What are we really seeing from Washington right now?
I think people are overstating the case if they think that suddenly we have all this great bipartisanship. I've been covering Washington events for more than two decades as a correspondent for the Chicago Tribune at one point. And this is, from time to time, you see these little blips, as you put it. You know, there was a bipartisan effort to reduce Bush's tax proposal in 2001 and 2002. We saw some move for the STEM research, expanding federal funding for it only yesterday. But for the most part, this is an extremely divided House and Senate, and I don't see at all that they're really moving to any kind of bipartisanship that has been traditional.
Charles Ogletree, many are suggesting we are seeing the calm before the storm. The vote anticipated on Judge Owen today, and there's still the wrangling over Pryor and Rogers Brown. We've been talking about it for the last few weeks on this show. But people say the big showdown is going to, and see if there is muster in this alliance, will be the appointment of eventually a Supreme Court justice. Do you believe that to be the case?
That's right, Ed. This is just the appetizer. The main entree is going to be whether or not Justice Antonin Scalia will be the next Chief Justice of the Supreme Court coming this June. And both sides are trying to set themselves up to make it a viable challenge and a viable nomination. I think this is an effort to say we can resolve things, but the real battle will come when Chief Justice Rehnquist, as all expect he will, announces his retirement in late June. And President Bush will likely nominate Antonin Scalia to be his substitute. The battle lines will be drawn. Remember, Scalia was confirmed 98-0 almost 20 years ago in 1986. Senator Harry Reid from Nevada has already said that he thinks that Scalia is smart and will be hard to oppose. Democrats are going to have a very hard time if Scalia is the nominee, and I think that this coalition of moderation will not hold when it comes to Supreme Court nominations.
Kelly, we were talking about all things being political while we were off the air. One of the things that's interesting here is to take a look at the politicizing of 08, if you will. And I say that in the true sense, internal politics. We saw John McCain really draw the line in the sand. Bill Frist, I'm sure, did not appreciate what happened with this alliance. Is this the Republican Party saying that, to people in general, we may not be as far right as you believe?
Well, it's certainly John McCain making himself that way. I mean, making it clear to people that he's willing to reach out. And I think even though this is a blip, okay, and I think we can agree that it probably is a blip, there's something to be said for some members of Congress finding a spine. If they don't find the center, they at least found a spine. And they have decided to reach across the aisle, even in a limited way, because they know that their constituencies are saying, hey, people, get something done. And I think that we cannot overlook that this, small though it may be, this small step, that it is significant. It certainly sets up John McCain as a leader. And if, after all, leadership is about problem solving, then let's give credit to these folks that said, this is a problem, we got to solve it, even if it's not going to hold for the long term. For right now, let's get off the dime.
You're right, Kelly. It's not solved, and that's the whole point. This, more than anything else, was a case of respect for Senate tradition. And this is what they want to preserve. But judging by the comments on both sides, one, we are not assured that this will not be a showdown later on. And two, both of them have been soundly criticized by their respective constituencies. And so this is far from being over. And you even hear the comments of Chris saying, you know, hey, it depends on how they behave. They act up, we're going to really do what we started to do. So this is just a delay. This is absolutely not a solution.
But I would say, George, to you that the larger constituencies, I mean, that's the folks that voted for people, are, I think, appreciate some movement. The special interest constituencies, yes, you're right, are not happy. But there's something to be said for demonstrating to folks, well, you put us here to vote on some things, to make some things happen, and we're at least trying.
Charles,
well,
let me ask you this.
The question is whether anything is really... Okay, go ahead, Ann.
No, and pick up on your point, but let me
ask you
this. Well,
the question is whether anything has happened. The fact of the matter is that nothing. The same people who the Democrats opposed 2 days ago, now they're going to allow to be voted up or down. So I don't see this as a move toward the center. I see this as a little bit of posturing with no real consequence in terms of judicial nominations or in terms of broader policy. But we'll wait and see.
Charles, let me ask you this before we move on to another subject. And that is the idea, as you suggest, if Rehnquist steps down and Scalia takes over, one would believe yet another ultra-conservative will take that spot. But isn't the key here in terms of the swing of power and the effect on the country when someone like Sandra Day O'Connor or a swing vote steps down? Many anticipate that she will not necessarily hang on much longer to that seat.
Well, I don't think there's going to be any equivocation from President Bush about who he would nominate for the Supreme Court. He told us in 1999, before he was elected the first time, that his model of justice was Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. He's done nothing to move from that. If O'Connor steps down, that's not going to change his view. Remember, he promoted Emilio Estrada. He made it clear his vision, and he thinks he has a mandate. So I think the court's going to take a strong tilt toward the right, at least in nominations.
Right.
And the Democrats don't have the votes to block it. The president has set up his vision, and I think he'll make sure it's implemented.
Right. And that's the point, the idea that replacing a conservative with a conservative won't be, as in some people's minds, detrimental as when those swing seats go.
Well, here's the position. Justice David Souter was considered a conservative, and now he's considered a moderate. And I don't think President Bush is going to take a chance on someone who looks like a Republican but acts like a Democrat. He's going to make sure that he nominates who he wants, and those are going to be strongly conservative candidates for the Supreme Court.
All right, let's move to another subject, and that is, we talked about it last week, the idea that Newsweek found itself in hot water, and now it's trying to clean it up. It's announced plans to limit the magazine's use of anonymous sources following a scandal in which one of its stories was blamed for a deadly protest in Afghanistan. That, of course, is the story about the desecration of the Quran. And many folks in the business understand, as often happens and did in this case, quote, unnamed sources were utilized and used to move this story forward. When we think historically, George Curry, there are many, many stories, including the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal initially, obviously Watergate, that banked on unnamed sources that brought to bear these stories. How detrimental, if at all, is this?
Well, I don't think it's detrimental, but I don't think Newsweek went far enough. What did most people won't acknowledge is if you're talking about Washington, D.C., most of the anonymous sources are government officials. And I have gone to these briefings at the White House, for example, where they would bring a cabinet member on saying, well, you can only use to identify this person as a high government ranking official. And what they're allowed to do is spin propaganda and not be held accountable. So I think Newsweek should have done three things. One, it should first discontinue the practice of allowing government officials to spin reporters like that. I think the rest of the press should do it as well. Two is if you're going to use unnamed sources, you should require somebody to corroborate that information. And thirdly, we should be going to the government to approve stories in advance, which is what they did here. That bothers me, and so does 2 years ago. The news director for CNN went to the Pentagon and said, we're thinking about using these generals to comment on the war. Are they okay with you? I mean, this is, to me, Newsweek in this instance showed it to two government officials. You're allowing them to basically publish your magazine, and I think I'm just offended by that as I am anything else.
I have to underscore what Georgia said. I want to pull out the part about cooperation. People bring up Watergate all the time as an example of unnamed sources, but they fail to also articulate that after they got the first information, they had to go and corroborate that. And that is what is the key. Now journalism leaders are saying over and over, there has got to be some more transparency of the kind that George just articulated, or you've got to cooperate that information. And that'll cut off a lot of these quote-unquote mistakes.
Though Newsweek will argue that this was part of their corroboration process here. In fact, they didn't just go on this.
No, they admitted they had one source. Yeah, that's what they admitted. That's what Mark Whitaker admitted.
And to follow up on what George said.
But Michael Isikoff said that one source was a continuing follow up on what they had been looking for. George, you know, you can parse all this along
one
the way.
One governmental source. Let me finish it. The quote was a knowledgeable U.S. government source. One source, which means it was a government official, and this is administration that misled us about going to Iraq, got nerves, be criticizing Newsweek. They should say, okay, let's disclose the name of that government source, and then people feel much better about it.
And I would add that they said that this was a source they had used before. So the way I'm interpreting it is they relied on past history with this source to stand for what they thought was absolute truth. And that in itself was cooperation, and that simply was not.
Well, I think this is much ado about nothing, because this news is going to be reported one way or the other, whether it's Newsweek or Time or someone else. And what's really going to happen is that if the Newsweek or Time doesn't report it, the blogs will, some other less reliable source will, and we'll see it there anyway. So I think that Newsweek has made an important stand, but I think the real issue is going to be, are we going to continue to investigate government action that might be serious and that might have an impact on the war on terrorism? And I think Newsweek should not retreat, but stand for it. We're going to report the news as long as we can verify it, and they're not going to be scooped by other less reliable and less knowledgeable sources.
And that's the point, Ogletree. That's the whole point. Newsweek and Time and our other major news organizations have a higher standard to meet.
Exactly.
And so they just, I mean, the blogs.
Well, I don't know if they have a higher standard.
Yes,
come on
they
now.
Do.
I mean,
they do. No, they do.
Let's be honest.
They're supposed to.
Yeah.
They're supposed to. I mean,
and they don't want to get scooped.
Yeah. And there it is, Georgia. And this is Michael Isikoff and John Barry, who were writers of this particular article, have suggested, and this is what I was talking about, that they sought comment from two Defense Department officials. One declined to respond. The other challenged another part of the story. And in fact, I'm sure they felt pressured to move this story rather than continue the process of trying to
find another. It was a small item, not even a real story here. And it wasn't just a matter of seeking comment, which is where I have the problem. They went there and showed the story to two government officials saying, is this all right? And that's what I have a problem with.
Well, and Professor Ogletree, professional journalists have a standard by which their work is governed. And whether or not it was exercised in this way, in fact, you just can't throw it out there as many people who blog do and just see if it sticks. There is supposed to be some standards of cooperation, of finding multi-sources, transparency, all of that stuff. Now, when we air. But there is very much a difference between the work of journalists and the work of just a blogger any given day.
I'm not trying to equate this with blockers. What I'm saying is that Newsweek wanted to get this story out. They did get it out. They made a mistake. But if the story like this comes again, they will pause. But I tell you, we will hear more about these stories. They won't be failed to be reported. They'll be reported. But it's a different standard. I would not concede that it's a higher standard because, if it bleeds, it leads. And these stories are going to get out one way or the other.
Well, that's TV. But no, I got to challenge you on that. There is a difference. I mean, the problem is with the internet and the cable and all that, there is this increased competition. So I agree with you on that aspect. But when you can have on the internet and set up any kind of blog, rumors start, there's no standard of double checks and all that, and the media fails, oftentimes it fails, but there are higher standards.
I'm not equating Newsweek or Time with blogs. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that this information will be covered, it will find its way into mainstream media, no matter what you say, and particularly something as important as terrorism in this war, someone's going to report it, even if they rely on some other less accountable source to put it out there first.
I don't think we're going to see
a change in standards. I think we're going to see a continuation of standards, maybe a little bit more credibility, a little bit more caution, but we're going to get the information whether it's right or whether it's wrong.
And Callie, like it or not, And I think this is what Professor Ogletree is alluding to. Bloggers, the internet, these quote-unquote new kinds of journalists, new kinds of writers, whatever you want to call them, they have put pressure on the venerable organizations of the media, news organizations, to hurry up and get these stories out, lest they be beat by a, quote, lesser journalist.
Yes, I understand the pressure, but the difference is that all we have, professional journalists, is our credibility, and that rests in corroboration and sourcing. The difference is what I tell college students all the time. Anybody can throw anything up on the internet and say, it's information I've gathered, but where did it come from? How can you prove to me that it's something that's reliable? That is the difference in the work of professional journalists.
Let me just ask you, Kelly, let's just watch this. Who's going to be fired from Newsweek? Who's going to be punished? What's going to be the consequences? If you tell me that this is going to be like CBS where they're going to clean house because of a story that couldn't be corroborated, then I'll agree with you. If business goes on with a simple retraction and no one's held accountable, I don't see the higher standard if there's no consequence for reporting a story that cannot be corroborated.
Well, let me say this. There is a higher standard. Now, whether or not people suffer at the high hands of it in this instance is another question. And I take your point, except to say that there's vast numbers of other professional journalists doing the job every day, meeting the higher standard. And whether or not Newsweek cleans house does not determine whether or not the rest of us go about the business of trying to source and cooperate in the way that we know makes capital J journalism what it is.
George, what do you say to people who will suggest that what we are seeing of late is simply a peek behind the curtain, and we've seen the wizard now, and maybe the august, venerable organizations of the past weren't quite as upfront and telling as they would want you to believe.
Well, I mean, this is not the first time we saw the wizard. Let's put that out there first. And secondly, you know, Charles mentioned the whole thing about Newsweek. They have come out with a policy. I just criticize it. It's not going far enough. But at least there's that effort there to do it. It is an imperfect art, craft. That's what we do. But, you know, I think it's, in the end, it's good because it's a healthy discussion. And it does raise the questions about how we use anonymous sources. And that is a problem that needs to be addressed.
All right. Well, we got into such a healthy discussion. We couldn't get to our other two matters today. But Kelly Crossley, Charles Ogletree, George Curry, I thank you so much for what is has been a very entertaining and I hope informative roundtable.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, George.
Hey, you must have time to kill.
I got about 10. All right.